the University Philosophical Society and our last Chamber debate of this year. I now invite our registrar, Albert Carey, to read the minutes of our last private business meeting. Hear, hear.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to what I hope will be a very lively debate, hopefully not too lively, but it should be fun. And I will apologise now just for the bad acoustics. I don't know if you can hear me in the back there. You should have showed up earlier. And it is quite hard to talk that loud. I don't have, you know, a booming voice. Unfortunately, Ian Paisley and his sons couldn't be here tonight. But when I, you know, I've obviously made some jokes about Catholics and Protestants in the past, but tonight I want to refrain from doing that in, you know, the spirit of reconciliation and peace between faiths and so on. You know, whatever. But when I read the poster for tonight's debate, you know, this house would untie Ireland. I was kind of confused. Untie Ireland. You know, what does that mean? And I'm sure Kelly, you know, who is our librarian and makes our posters, is now panicking, wondering if there was a spelling mistake or something. But actually, there was no spelling mistake. I'm not dyslexic. It was actually just the poster itself. You know, as my eyes were being assaulted so badly by the poster, I actually just couldn't read properly. But look, you know, there may have been some complaints about the poster, but it is very difficult to create a poster about this topic without offending someone somehow. And you know, while Americans are renowned across the world for their cultural sensitivity, I think Kelly actually made the right choice and erred on, you know, the side of caution by just making the poster, you know, so ugly that no one would look at it for long. Now, I am aware that our membership, you know, we have a significant amount of Yanks or Americans. Now, obviously, this debate deals with, you know, Irish, you know, political and indeed cultural issues. And Americans, you know, may not always be the most well-informed, to put it lightly. But, you know, even if your great-grandparent was Irish, and, you know, even though you, you know, substantially subsidize our education, thank you again, you know, it really doesn't mean you're actually going to understand the troubles. Most Irish people, you know, don't really understand the troubles. So I thought I would give, you know, a little glossary of terminology that might help you to kind of follow along a bit better tonight. So first up, we have the IRA. Now you should like this one, as most Americans are actually big fans of the IRA. You know, as they say, one person's, you know, terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. Now that obviously doesn't apply here, as IRA refers to an individual retirement account in American finance, which is useful for Americans as they, you know, don't have state pensions or healthcare. Now obviously you have various different types of IRA, so you have PIRAs, OIRAs, RIRAs, etc. It's all very complicated. I don't really understand, but essentially they're just, you know, different forms of pensions, so don't worry about it too much. Next up we have, you know, Sinn Féin, which is an Irish Republican Party. Obviously totally unrelated to an IRA in any way. To this day, there's no affiliation between Sinn Féin and, you know, the individual retirement account. Next up, we have Republican. You know, speaking of Republicans, so, you know, this should be pretty familiar to Americans in the audience. It basically refers to a political group or party with little respect for election results that kind of seeks to impose their will, you know, on a country despite them. Next up, we have Armalite and Ballot Box. Now, this obviously refers to the election policy of Donald Trump's Republican Party. Then we have Irish Car Bomb. This is, of course, a cocktail with negative connotations. For some reason, you know, Americans don't really understand. You don't actually get them in Ireland. I'm not sure why. We do have, you know, the 9/11 Spritz, of course. Next up, we have Death Squads. Now, this is obviously a touchy subject, but it basically refers to, you know, something quite controversial, which were the new stormtroopers in the new Star Wars movies, which Americans should be familiar with. And obviously those movies got mixed reviews, so I don't want to, you know, dwell on that anymore. Then we have Chucky Our Law. This is an Irish phrase, which translates as, hello, nice to meet you. anyone in Ireland would be very impressed if an American says that to them, especially, you know, in the North, where Irish is less widely spoken, so it would be very impressive there. Then we have West Brit. This refers to Peter O'Brien. And then finally we have Orange Man, which refers to Donald Trump. So thank you.
There being none, I shall duly sign. Madam Treasurer, are there any fines?
There are no fines.
President of Queen's University Belfast, are there any reports to be read?
There are no reports to be read.
The time for questions is now open.
Mr. President, are there any motions on notice?
There are no motions on notice.
Mr. President, are there any motions not on notice?
There are no motions not on notice.
The time for questions is now closed.
This brings us to the general business of the Society. Are there any motions to be raised in general business? Okay. There being no further business, this private business meeting is adjourned. Our president of Queen's University Belfast shall retire with our and return with our speakers for tonight's debate. Here's
speeches, I kind of run through the speakers in the debate, you know, maybe give you a little bio, maybe tell you a bit about them, make fun of them a little bit, and if I have, you know, the speaking order, I let everyone know what that is. But you know, I have to work with what I have. Our secretary Tom Comer, you know, he invites the speakers, you know, when he confirms, they, you know, he creates the speaking order, and oftentimes putting speakers on the wrong side, or, you know, purposely making the side of the debate that he agrees with much stronger. But anyway, the point is, I have to ask Tom for the speaking order, and that means, you know, my text to Tom and Tom's, you know, text back to me is kind of a point of failure. So oftentimes, Tom will send me the wrong speaking order, or the wrong speakers, or leave out people's second names, etc. Anyway, so I'm getting kind of sick of this, so I thought I'd just read out me and Tom's chat. So he said, you know, I hadn't asked him this week because I was just sick of it. And he said to me, do you want the speakers? And I said, yeah, go on. And then he said, keep wanting. With a little like emoji with cool sunglasses. And then he said, only messing. The real joker, that guy. So then I'll read out word for word what he said. He said, Rose Conway Walsh, lol, in all caps. Then he said, Ian Marshall, in brackets, Northern Irish Unionist who sat in the Shannon. Thank you, Tom, I also have Google. And he said, Dr. Steve Aiken, OBE, Emma D'Souza, me, this is not the order. Then he said, Stefan, the postgrad, which was quite confusing, and then he said, two Queen's students. So, now, there are a few problems with this list, and I'm just gonna tell you them. So firstly, Rose Conway Walsh. It should actually read Rose Conway Walsh TD. It should also read Ian Marshall OBE. Now, obviously, you know, found that out by doing some research on those guest speakers, you know, doing my due diligence, unlike Tom Comer. So I pulled up, you know, Wikipedia. Now, Ian Marshall's Wikipedia reads as follows. Ian James Marshall, OBE, is a farmer. And a UUP politician from Armagh. He was elected to the Shannon as the first unionist politician elected to the Oireachtas since the 1930s. Obviously, more importantly, he is a farmer, though. Now, Ian Marshall was elected to the agricultural panel, and his candidacy was supported by both Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. Now, Rose Conway Walsh, incidentally, also sat on the Shannon agricultural panel during the same period, so I suppose that is another aspect of this debate. You know, two former colleagues in the Shannon who once debated, you know, the most serious and pressing agricultural issues in, you know, the highest legislative body in the land. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but, you know, they debated in, you know, one of the legislative bodies in the land. And I suppose, in the spirit of reconciliation and all that, I think it is useful to actually reflect on the similarities between, you know, the Irish and Northern Irish legislatures, you know, particularly the Shannon. You know, the Shannon obviously is a building full of people that does nothing. The Northern Irish Assembly is a building with no people that actually does nothing.
It's okay, I know where you live.
But obviously both are, you know, ex-senators coming down from, you know, more serious issues and, you know, interesting and pressing agricultural issues of our day to talk about something a little bit more lighthearted tonight. Now, personally, agriculture is one of my passions as well, but unfortunately, we have to leave the wellies at home tonight. So Dr. Steve Aiken, OBE, obviously has the postnominal OBE, which Tom didn't mention. Now we don't actually recognize titles and nobility here in Ireland, but, you know, we will play nice for now and, you know, let them use the titles. Obviously, once we unite, the tyranny begins then. So Dr. Aiken is former leader of the UUP and veteran of the Royal Navy, where he commanded two nuclear submarines, which incidentally is more nuclear submarines than the entire proposition bench has ever commanded. Then we have Emma D'Souza. Emma D'Souza is a writer, political commentator, journalist, and activist. He, you know, has sought to uphold the Good Friday Agreement and very actually successful in challenging and changing UK immigration rules. Unfortunately, I couldn't find anything on her Wikipedia about expertise in agriculture or submarines or anything.
I'll have you know I make my own wine.
Now, next we have Tom. Now, it has been said before, and there have been rumors going around, that Tom is the chair of Ogre Sinn Féin. But I actually do have to clarify, you know, for a serious debate like this one, Tom is actually not the chair of Ogre Sinn Féin anymore. Unfortunately, impeached and forced to step down due to his offensively bad haircut. Then we have Stefan, the postgrad. Now, as far as I can tell, the rest of the speakers given to me by Tom are incorrect. I don't know if Stefan, the postgrad, is here with us tonight. But I do think this is actually a good name for a rapper. Which is not great to introduce someone by that name. And then we have two Queen's students. Now, obviously, that's also pretty mysterious. I don't know anything about them. I will say that I am a big fan of Queen's University Belfast. Obviously, it is the second oldest and second best university on the island. Simply because it allows us to say that UCD is actually not even the second best university. Now let's get on with the debate. Thank you.
The motion that stands before the House tonight is this House will unite Ireland. Standing orders are as follows. Speeches are a maximum of 7 minutes in length and 10 minutes for guests. After the first and before the last minute of each speech, our Treasurer Anna will speakers from opposing sides and members of the opposition are free to offer points of information. We encourage general audience participation during our debates. So if you hear something you like, you can shout, hear, hear, and if you hear something you don't like, you can shout, nay. We prioritise respect and dignity for our debates, And as a result, if anyone has any concerns about what is said tonight, you can contact me via present@tcphil.com. Alright, so now we get to go over to our lovely speakers for tonight's debate. So, speaking first in proposition, I would like to welcome Ellie Burns to the floor. I didn't know I was going first, so just get the jitters out of the way. So, we are for the side, this house would unite Ireland. I am coming all the way up from Belfast, all the way down here, to deliver this debate, this speech, because I believe that we should unite Ireland, that it is time to unite Ireland, and that it is inevitable that we will unite Ireland. And let's get on to why. I do not need to give a history lecture here today about the history of this country. We are all more than aware. I'm sure you have a better education of getting it taught to you than we do, but whatever. I can only be jealous. I don't need to go over it, but Northern Ireland itself is over just over 100 years old, and 100 years of instability and this kind of waiting on doom, you know, the impending day. One community is hoping for a day that will never come, and the other side is wanting it to come sooner. And it just ends up coming into this boiling pots of older generations having such strong opinions, and the younger kids being like, who gives a shit? To be quite honest. But with Brexit, with the protocol, and with attitudes that are changing and cross-community projects that are taking part up north, there is a tide of changing in opinions, and also in the makeup of our country up north, which is the same one. So you have previously had a Protestant majority up north. However, the 2021 Northern Irish Life and Times survey found that it was 43.5% Protestant and 48.7% Catholic for the first time in 100 years. So a state that was made for that to be impossible achieved that in 100 years. And in fact, if we actually look at 2017, there was analysis done off of the 2011 census saying that it would take us 10, 20, 30 years to be reached the proportions we have today in 2021. This track that is said for when United Ireland will the first one be in 2027, as some have thrown out? Will it be in 2030, 2050? It's on a faster track than we realise, and Brexit has only added a lot more fuel onto that train. But why has it added a lot more fuel onto that train? The protocol has shaken us up a little bit up north. We really didn't need that in our time of economic crisis, which I know you share, and I will get on to that, because I'm sure the opposition have a lot to say in that topic. But with the protocol, we are in an even better position to unite. And that will help us, both North and South, be economically stronger in the long run. There was analysis done in Dublin University, Dublin City University, DCU, sorry for naming them here. John Doyle argues that the North's current level of subvention, because, you know, we're poor, would not carry forward into United Ireland. In fact, research is due to be published this coming year in June, that the three largest elements in Northern Ireland's budgets are pensions, and that these share the UK national debt and defence spending. However, Doyle argues that most of the money involved in these transfers would not apply in the event of a United Ireland. The cost of the subvention, objectively in terms of what is relevant to the debate about Irish unity, is no more than £2 billion to £3 billion. So you will probably hear arguments from the opposition tonight trying to scaremonger into the, we can't afford this, we can't afford anything. No one can afford anything right now. But does that mean that we shouldn't live our life? Does that mean that we shouldn't do right by our identities? Does that mean we shouldn't do right by history and decolonize? When you look to any other country across the world and see that they are decolonizing themselves, we celebrate it. We're like, good for you. You have stuck true to your identity that has been tried to be battered, and you've respected both sides of the communities. I feel that in the North, this kind of avoidance of the topic and the debate that we are having here today is a negative. I myself am from a Protestant community up north. I'm from the Shankill. And yet I am on this side of the debate here today. The main things that would help
a United Ireland run smoothly, because the other side will also try to argue that my community, the streets I grew up on, that I have experience in, will be given to civil unrest, which they did anyway with the protocol. But just because there will be civil unrest does not mean that we can just take a step back and say, oh, we'll just wait forever and ever. Because the reason for that civil unrest in that area is not actually about, realistically, these issues at its core. It's about areas like mine, working class Protestant estates, not being listened to or represented because the DUP are not sitting in Stormont, and therefore nothing's being done for them, and this is being exacerbated, and that is where we're seeing these effects come from. And the fact that we've had already talks about a United Ireland with multiple political parties, Alliance didn't want to go, and obviously the DUP didn't go either, but not going to those events and not preparing for a potential United Ireland, which by multiple, by the way, political scientists says is inevitable, it's just going to leave them stranded. I mean, up north, we've seen what happens when you have a referendum with absolutely no plan, no framework, no idea, and it is crap, and I do not want that again. So whether, in my opinion, you agree with the United Ireland or not, you need to be preparing for it, because if you want people from the community I'm from to feel heard, to feel seen, to feel welcomed in the United Ireland that is inevitable, then we need to start positively having the communications, having the work start to be done. Citizens' assemblies, talks, political parties, even if they oppose it, getting involved. My side tonight will talk about the fears that this side will try to scaremonger. I am here today to say do not listen to this side scaremongering of what potentially could happen on the United Ireland and why you don't want us up north to join you down here. We're good crack too, I swear, okay? Like, our booze are cheaper right now, and like, if you've ever been up to Belfast, it is good crack, although I'm liking the 6 a.m. thing you're about to have down here. But anyway, do not listen to the scaremongering that they're going to try and tell you. Do not listen to the fact that my community completely doesn't want it, because I'm telling you, plenty of people like me who I talk to are not as opposed to United Ireland as you think. And in fact, in the Northern Ireland Life and Time survey, it was found that the protocol and Brexit have heightened opinions of approval for United Ireland, even in communities of unionist areas. The time is coming very soon. It is barreling towards us. It is not something we should shy away from. And in my opinion, it's inevitable. Thank you.
It's a privilege to join you tonight for this debate that this house would unite Ireland and run it from London. Oh, sorry, that's not tonight, that's next week's debate. I'm on the other side. I'd just like to say that I feel slightly intimidated, not by the fact that there's so many people here this evening, but the fact that Rose told me her son and all his mates are in the audience. And if I get this wrong, I'll probably not get home. So... I suppose what we're considering this evening, ladies and gentlemen, it's a bit like contemplating a marriage. It's an arranged marriage for that matter, and incidentally, it's statistically the most successful type of marriage, as opposed to a forced marriage without consent, which statistically is the worst type of marriage you can have. So I thought I'd begin by looking at professional matchmaking and consider what makes a good relationship. Obviously, things like shared values, goals, interests, or ambitions could ultimately determine relationship success or not. But what may be more important are the significant number of incompatibilities in a relationship that can often lead to disagreement and breakup. Things such as money, ambition, emotional intelligence, political views, religious views, self-care and health all play a part, as does incompatible sex drives. Mind you, I'm not sure this will have much of a bearing on the unification debate, although you just don't know. So what are the arguments made to support uniting the island now? Firstly, many of the arguments are justified by looking backwards about unfairness, about inequality, about oppression, about righting wrongs and undoing injustices, about imperialism, about the famine, about civil rights issues of the 40s, 50s and 60s, It's about actions of state actors in both jurisdictions during the long, dark period of the Troubles. For some, it's actually about holding the entire Unionist and British people today in some way responsible or accountable for these blights in our history, something they actually bear no responsibility for. Just as it's completely unreasonable to hold nationalists and Republicans responsible for activities 50 years ago, at the height of the Troubles, because it's simply not acceptable. Indeed, much of the Uniting Ireland debate is built on emotion and ideology, and not actually on evidence. It's built on ideology that believes it must just be better if we didn't have a border. That's the border that we know is now completely invisible, and it's an outworking of the Good Friday Agreement. It's a logic that would dictate that we shouldn't have any borders. It's, well, except for Catalonia maybe, or the Basque region, or maybe Scotland, or perhaps where it fits an agenda for some. And it could be foolhardy to assume that removing borders is a panacea from an agreed settlement. 33 years after German reunification, many issues still persist, with many walls in the mains, acting as barriers to true reconciliation. Shocking, I would suggest, 33 years later, when everyone started from a position of seeing themselves as German and remaining German, and not as we have here, where some see themselves as Irish, some British, some both and all who wish to remain as such. Indeed, disindifference and diversity and lack of agreement and understanding of sensitivities was highlighted last year when President Michael D. Higgins declined an invitation to attend a church service in Armagh, marking 100 years since the formation of Northern Ireland, actually a service of commemoration and hope, emphasising the fact that we never have really reconciled the partition of the island. I don't believe that Unionists and Loyalists have ever understood the hurt and pain caused by partition to Nationalists and Republicans, and conversely, that Nationalists or Republicans have ever truly understood the importance of Northern Ireland, its place within the United Kingdom, to Unionists and Loyalists. And it's this lack of understanding and empathy and respect that presents the biggest challenge. For the last 100 years, we've grown together but apart, with a republic built on independence, emancipation and expansion, while Northern Ireland's been built on an identity and difference and protecting and holding on to what we have. I've no doubt that some in this House this evening will compare Northern Ireland to the Republic of Ireland. But what they fail to tell you is that Northern Ireland is a region, and you can't compare a region to a state in any credible economic model. Modelling should actually be done between Northern Ireland and, say, Donegal, or Galway, or Sligo, and not as the arguments are presented with a nation state. Some here will also tell you that Northern Ireland is a failed state, on life support, in receipt of a UK subvention. But what they won't tell you is the subvention of the regions is a normal part of national economics. The UK and London subvents the West Country, the North East, the North West. It subvents Wales and Scotland. And Dublin subvents the regions such as Donegal, Mayo, Sligo. That's how national economics work. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to unite the island, you first need to unite the people. We've so much to learn about each other and still so much to understand. Our past, whether we like it or not, defines us. And as Queen Elizabeth stated in 2010, we must bow to history but not be bound by history. This week we lost one of our greatest academics and historians in Northern Ireland with the untimely passing of Dr. Eamon Phoenix, a gentleman and a scholar, someone who brought our history to life with his objectivity, his frankness, his honesty and his velvet smooth voice. Asked by the Belfast Telegraph a number of years ago about any good advice he'd received in his career, he told the interviewer that one piece came from FSL Lyons, a former provost in this very great university, and a great Irish historian born in Derry. He wrote at the outbreak of the Troubles that to understand the past is to cease to live in it, something that has always guided Dr. Phoenix in trying to demythologise history, to recall it as it was, to tell the narrative without rewriting or distorting the history. Perhaps we all should aspire to emulate Dr. Phoenix and FSL Lyons and acknowledge that our past presents us with challenges and brings unconscious bias to everything we do, including this debate. Prior to my election, I was always told that Leinster House was a cold house for unionism, something I certainly found not to be the case. In fact, I made many fantastic lifelong friends and allies in the Shannon, but there's a caveat. Even though it was not a cold house for unionism, I was always an outsider. And coincidentally, Martin O'Neill, former Celtic manager, a Kilray man from County Londonderry, from a strong Derry GAA family, revealed last week in his autobiography that he often felt he was an outsider when he had the role as Republic of Ireland football team manager. Both of us from Northern Ireland, both of us Nordies, both of us from the Black North, and both getting the feeling that some will never consider us truly Irish, or indeed British for that matter, despite being from different religious and political backgrounds. Ladies and gentlemen, before we try to reunite this island, we must first unite the people within Northern Ireland and the people within the Republic. Rudyard Kipling's 1910 poem, If, is my favourite piece of poetry. It's about advice from a father to his son about moving through life with composure, always exercising self-control, integrity and humility, and never letting events, good or bad, go to your head. It's very fitting in our politics at the moment, and as Kipling writes, if you can keep your head when all around you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. Good advice, I think you'd agree, at this time, with composure, integrity, trust, truth, humility, and patience often absent from the conversation. But rather than asking if, I suggest we ask, what if? What if we first unite the people north and south, east and west, across this island and between two islands? What if we deal with reconciliation? What if we have a conversation with open minds? What if we have respect for each other? What if we first make Northern Ireland work? What if we implement all three strands of the Good Friday Agreement? What if we make sure we get this right? The virtues and merits of Irish unity have not been properly demonstrated yet. And little evidence currently exists that would support or guarantee that my children or your children would be better, healthier, wealthier and better off in a united Ireland. Any salesman will tell you because it's better than what you already have. To sell the unity argument, you need to demonstrate something that's better than what we already have. A better proposition with obvious benefits, which to date have not been substantiated. What's more, despite what some this evening will tell you, despite the propaganda, the spin and any demographic change, the polls continue to indicate that the numbers have remained relatively unchanged in Northern Ireland since the 1990 Good Friday Agreement. 40% still support the Union, 40% still support unity, and there's still 20% that are undecided. Uniting Ireland based on the pursuit of ideology and the absence of uniting the people could have dire consequences and result in more division than we ever had. It could present more problems and solutions. As one TD in Leinster House told me, a united Ireland's a bit like heaven. It sounds like a really great place, but we're just not ready for it yet. I urge everyone to consider carefully what you're really voting for here this evening. If you want something better for generations to come, if you want to fix something you consider to be broken, if you support the Good Friday Agreement and the principle of consent, and you truthfully want this successful marriage, if you really want Irish unity, and here's the irony, that I suggest you vote against this motion. Before you vote to unite Ireland, this House should vote to unite the people. Don't let new nationalism become old unionism. And the ironical truth that after years of ideological struggle, Republicans are becoming the very thing they opposed. Supporting this motion before we deal with reconciliation and respect could be counterproductive and risks pushing Irish unity farther away than ever. Thank you.
And it's great for me as an Irish Republican to, it's great to see so many of you here. It's great to see so many people interested in this question, in the constitutional question, because it concerns us all. And it's really good to have my old colleague Ian here. We spent 2 years debating this every day, trying to convince each other of different positions, and for Steve to be here as well. And Ellie, you
Well, fantastic. I thought we could have all gone home when you spoke, said everything that we needed to say. And it's wonderful. I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's indicative, like, to see somebody like yourself from the Shankill Road and talking about what really, really matters to you. Because you'd often have unionists who purport to speak to that they had to speak for the community in the Shankill Road. So that's why I think it's so important to hear the real voices and to hear them directly. So I welcome you, and I welcome all of the Queen's students here tonight, regardless of what their constitutional preference is. But Irish unity means different things to different people. We accept that. We too, and I know Ian spoke about, you know, unity of people. Absolutely, who doesn't want unity of people? Unity of people across this island. We certainly don't differ in that regard. But we do want to be in charge of our own affairs. We are a tiny, tiny island. 5 million people in the south, 2 million, almost 2 million people in the north, just 7 million people. Like, London has a population of 9.5 million. We are a tiny island. It never ever made sense to me, forever ever I got in politics, for us, for our island to be divided. I would look at the map of the world, and we all did when we looked at geography, and we see this tiny island off the coast of Europe and of Britain. And to think that our island was divided, I just couldn't make sense of it as a child, and I certainly cannot make sense of it now. We've been part of the EU now for almost 50 years, and we've seen many, many changes, mostly changes for the better, particularly in regard to equality. But the damage that has been done by Brexit has been immense, and we haven't even yet modelled the extent of the economic and the opportunity cost of Brexit to our island. And we have to remember that part of our island was dragged out of the EU against the will of the people. They weren't listened to. They weren't at all listened to. The north of our island was just collateral damage in the whole Brexit conversation. Britain is, as we are now, Britain is struggling to get its own island together. And that was very obvious to us a couple of days ago. They didn't even consider the consequences for Ireland. I spent the last 2 days in Westminster in various meetings with MPs from England and from Scotland and from Wales. And one thing was very, very clear, that our island just isn't a priority for them. No harm to them. But I'm sure, I come from Mayo, from Belmullet. You know, Blackpool doesn't feature great in my day-to-day work either. So why would it? In fact, one could argue that anything north of Watford was not a priority for Westminster. I lived in London for 13 years. I was born in London as well. So I know how they think in that sense. But part of the thing that's fascinating, I think, about Brexit is, and the push for Brexit and the vote for Brexit in the UK, that I absolutely believe that the unintended consequence of Brexit is the breakup of the Union. It's the very thing that they wanted to protect, particularly nationalism within England. You look at what's happening in Scotland. We met with the SNP yesterday. We see a Supreme Court case coming up there on the 23rd. Again, they are headlong into independence for Scotland. They too want to be in charge of their own affairs. You even look at Wales, and I honestly would never have thought that Wales would consider a breakaway from England. And now you have, again, I talked to Welsh people in terms of the revival of the Welsh language, and in terms, I think it's something like 38% of people now, from what used to be 15, 17% of people interested in independence there. They too want to be in charge of their own affairs. Now, I want to address one of the questions in for those who say we cannot afford a united Ireland. I would say that we cannot afford not to unite our island. The figure of 10 billion is frequently quoted as representing the British government annual subvention in the north, as Ian, you've said many times yourself. And in reality, it's an accounting exercise that bears no connection to the future cost of a united Ireland, and is only used to dissuade people from supporting Irish unity. The total, and you said it, Ellie, the total includes the central government costs allocated to the north that would not be relevant in a united Ireland. The subvention includes pensions, the UK national debt repayments, defence expenditure, and other non-identified expenditure, and underestimates Northern Ireland's share of the Britain's tax revenues. And you rightly quoted John Doyle from DCU recently when he estimated that the current subvention that is likely to transfer in the case of a united Ireland would represent a deficit of approximately 2.8 billion, or about a quarter of the headline figure. But more importantly, he outlined the size of the subvention is not the most important issue at all. Of course it's important, and it's important to refute it, but how we support sustainable and economic growth and to maximise the benefits of a larger and an integrated all-Ireland economy at a level sufficient to cover this subvention is what we should be focusing on. There is nothing inherent in the north of Ireland to say that we cannot and should not contribute positively to an all-Ireland economy. The north didn't always receive a subvention, and at the time of partition, the Belfast region was the most industrialised part of the island. So I would really, really argue that partition hasn't served anybody, either the unionist community or the nationalist community, Republicans or whatever you might be. But when we look at it, by 1938, the UK government was subsidising the cost of public services in the north. And in the late 1930s, the north, the unemployment rate was 50%. It was 20%, a per capita income of just over half of the British average. So you can see what partition has done to both sides of our island. One of the biggest issues to be negotiated between Irish and British governments following the referendums that resulted in the decisions to create a united Ireland would be the liability for pensions. The latest published figures for the North relate to 2018, and that gives a total cost of 3.4438 billion. This cost of pensions would be unlikely to transfer in Europe. In fact, it absolutely wouldn't, because if you look at a British person who's living in the south or living in Spain or Italy or anywhere else who's worked in the public service in Britain, then that comes from their retirement pensions come from the British exchequer. So I really think that those figures that are put forward, and they're being continuously examined, and I know you say in around that there's no evidence. Just because the evidence is dismissed doesn't mean that it's not there. And it's from very well-known and well-respected academics, not only from this country, but from but internationally. And I think as you go, you can look at some of the stuff that's been done by the ESRI recently as well. I know Steve is making his arguments for when he comes up.
No, I'm not shuddering from a sedentary position. You're okay.
But honestly, I think the figures are there to back it up. I'm not going to bore you with them tonight. With the rest of them. People can read for themselves. People here are all very educated. They can read the academic papers that have been written and all of the evidence and the econometrics and everything else. Isn't that right, Tom? The other thing I want to talk to you about is health, because I think it's really important. Because one of the things that would be said over the years is that the NHS provides us with free access to healthcare. And I know that because when I came back to this country after accessing the NHS in London, I was quite shocked at how much you had to pay to go to the doctor and how much you had to pay for your prescriptions. But that is not the case now. And I would refer you to the ESRI report again that's been done on primary healthcare and access to healthcare. And that will show you. Also, even in London last week, when my sister said to get an appointment at the doctor who lives there, you have to make a 3-week appointment. So that doesn't give me any great joy, because the people need healthcare, and people in the north need healthcare as well. But it's no longer an argument against Irish unity. What I want, and what my party would want, is an all-Ireland health service, a national health service that's based on need, not on ability to pay. People across this island, whether they be north and south, are dying early because they cannot access healthcare. Does that mean I'm finished? I also want to just I just want to point you to just one other thing in terms of life expectancy and the lower life expectancy in the north, because I think that's another key metric that you measure things against as well. Education, the negative effect of partition is nowhere more apparent than a third level education. The low number of cross-border enrolments in 2020-2021 academic year, students from Northern Ireland made up less than 1%, 1,624 third level enrolments. We are making it impossible for people to access education, third level education across the island in the way that we need to. And that is having an impact on productivity, on economic growth, and of everything else. We need an all island third level education system that people can access and that people can make the right choices on. I have much more to say, but also I would just say in terms of third level education, I just want to say it's not only the educational attainment, but in terms of peace and reconciliation that we need across our island, third level education plays a key role there. We want a united Ireland, not only because of the people who died for it or what was set out in our proclamation, but because it makes absolutely economic, social sense on every level to have our island back together again. And I really hope that I will see it in my lifetime and that you will see it as well, Ian and Steve and everybody else.
Speaking about Wales, for that, Fintan Dooley, and I will hopefully try to convince you that Ireland should not be united. Certainly, at least not for now. And why you ask why someone with such a Republican name is speaking against Irish unity? Well, I hope, given the background of my fellow speakers, this might get me an OBE. You also may ask why I'm dressed like some sort of business wizard. I'm not Gandalf's new intern, but rather I'm following some old rules from the film that aren't enforced, but I'm trying to bring back the trend. Think of Jacob Rees-Mogg, but more Trinity. I'm in fact wearing the academic robes of an undergraduate student. Also, the final part to my introduction, if my points feel scattered or somewhat ludicrous, I do apologise. I was only told that I was speaking in this at around 10:30 last night, and the remainder of that evening was spent trying to really, really nail my Ian Paley impression. So, this debate is most certainly emotionally charged. The battles of the not-so-distant past are still being fought in our hearts and in our minds. I, however, am a heartless engineering student, whose heart was torn out during the third chemistry lecture. So, let's try the pragmatic approach. So let's move on. So, in Northern Ireland, the largest employer is in fact the civil service. While an extremely important job, one thing that Ireland does certainly not need at the moment is more civil servants. Mm-hmm. Equally, in the event of the tricolour flying over Stormont, we have a severe problem. Most of these civil servants are going to have to be made redundant. And because simply a system designed to support 64 million people does not translate into a system designed to support 7 million. And one thing that a new state certainly does not need is more unemployment. Furthermore, as mentioned recently by the proposition, the NHS, despite its many, many failures, is far more effective than our HSE. In Ireland, private healthcare is still necessary as the wait lists become longer and longer. Even with the added Northern Irish infrastructure, HSE just won't be able to cope, and public healthcare in the island would simply collapse. My thesis regarding defence, because I wasn't expecting anybody to speak about it. A major concern exists around the defence of this island in the event of a united Ireland. While yes, Ireland is militarily neutral, we are far from politically neutral. And this is placing us at an extreme risk for potential enemies, notably the Russians at the moment, who are continually buzzing our airspace and deciding that it's a good idea to do missile drills off the coast of Kerry. even with the amalgamation of the Irish regiments and the 503 squadron into the Irish force, we simply can't do it. If we, defence is a nation's insurance policy. Is a united Ireland worth risking our safety, ladies and gentlemen? And there's a line in between. The world is once more in a really dangerous place. As the new Tsar attempts to spread his empire, we are all at risk. Yeah. Thank you. Constitutionally, a mess also stands. Many, many parts of the Irish Constitution, which I decided was a good idea to bring with me, would have to be changed. Principally, Articles 1 through 14. One article which I shall read to you in a moment. Most of these sections will not be changed by love nor money by the majority of the Irish state. Consider for a moment the nation. The Irish nation hereby affirms its inalienable and indefensible sovereign right to choose its own form of government. Sorry, that's the wrong one. Perhaps we'll leave that for a second. However, there many of your questions are at rest around the role of the president in the New Ireland, the role of the monarch in the role of the British monarch in the New Ireland, also the role of making this a representative democracy and something that, frankly, we're going to have to deal with a lot of problems. So, how bad is the status quo at the moment, actually? A shared community between these islands is for the benefit of all of us, even if Sammy Wilson's British pork sausages have to be chilled on their way into the Tesco shelves. A significant risk to our fragile peace is posed in a united Ireland. Many unionists feel today continually that they're under siege, much like the winning knights during the siege of Derry. While naturally, the unionists of Ulster are not the whole problem, they are a significant group and their cooperation is required for a functioning community. We are well used to hearing Ulster says no again and again, but we now have a situation where Ulster says maybe, sometimes. Between Tuesdays and Thursdays. Okay, perhaps it is precarious. Sorry? Yes.
Should, in the spirit of Trinity here, should we bow to the same forces that Edmund Carson did, in the same way that the British government did, in the event of being out of Ireland, that the idea that the UVF and the UVA might rise up, is that the message that they are providing us with? The idea that we should bow to foreign forces or to enemy forces and put a break on our democracy in the name of peace? Is it no to democracy in the name of
please? Thank you, Dermot. We have two communities on this island, and one of these communities is loyal, is somewhat loyal to the British monarchy, and unfortunately, we're going to have to put up with them. While I'm not suggesting that we all salute the monarch, there's going to end up being some, likely, in the event of what has happened so far, some sort of strange situation where we've got two heads of state. However, allow me to move on, thank you very much. So it is a precarious situation, but at least there is some communication between a rather binary society, which is frankly better than none. And the cooperation between sides requires a strange mix of Britishness and Irishness. Perhaps a united Ireland isn't actually necessary. Now, the natural point. We can't afford it. Ireland as a state is struggling at the moment to provide the most basics of means to its citizens, and I doubt that adding on another 2 million people, even with their infrastructure, could actually allow for us to provide a proper solution. Perhaps two governments are better than one in this case. Equally, Article 3 of the Constitution states that unification of Ireland must be peaceful. We have no guarantee that that would be the case. A peace of transition is not a certainty. As recent times have sorted, as Ulster paramilitaries threaten to reorganise and Sierra is suddenly becoming real again, we have a severe, severe problem. In order to ensure the prosperity of both communities on the island, perhaps a two-state solution is necessary. Margaret Thatcher once said that the nature of life is conservative. I knew this was going to... So, consider for a moment getting on a plane with a pilot of questionable qualifications. Yes, the plane may be fine, who knows, it might go to somewhere extra. Rather, we can deal with a path to prosperity that we already have and allow for us to prosper together. Thank you.
really quick preamble because usually speakers tend to give you a bit funny stuff before they speak in the chamber. Apparently that's things are done. I wouldn't know, I don't normally go to these debates. I'm more of a fan of the hist, you know. I love being 10% of the audience, really, really it in the atmosphere, you know. Makes me really feel wanted, you know. Anyway, I need to clarify a few things before I start. In this chamber, week on week on week, since the start of the term, I have been degraded. I have been defiled. I have been embarrassed by this very man behind me. I just need to clear something up once and for all. I have not, am not, and will never be a member of Uber Sinn Féin. So yeah. So my name's Tom, for anyone who doesn't know, and I come from the greatest city on earth. That's right, and we heard the accent and thought, wow, Mr. Worldwide. I am an international student. Yeah. I come from the wee apple. I come from the city that sometimes sleeps, the Venice of the North. Sprawling urban metropolis on foothills of the Moor Mountains. The Rome of South Down. The place where the chicken fillet roll was not invented, but it was perfected. The real NYC, Newry City. So yeah. Emphasis on city, one cathedral, two shopping centres. Yeah. But anyway, on to the speech. So Northern Ireland is known for a couple of things. Van Morrison's music, emphasis on music. George Best's footballing ability, emphasis on footballing ability. And the greatest peace deal the world has seen in decades. If we define peace and success as the de-escalation of political violence, the North has done exceedingly well. The system which led the status quo, i.e. the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement, have been nothing short of exemplary. A lot of speakers tonight are going to talk about what state they prefer, whether it's the South, whether it's the UK, whatever it is. I'm not going to talk about what ideology in particular I prefer. I want to illustrate the point of view I come from throughout this debate and show my true intentions lie, which is material benefits for people of both the Republic and mainland UK. I'm only wearing this green blazer because my orange one was in the wash. Just but yeah, I have nothing but pure and utter empathy and respect for the people in front of me for no other reason other than the fact that they are just that, people. Steve Aiken is just a dude, just a guy, just trying his best to protect his union. Rose Conway Walsh, again, just a person, just trying her best to protect her political party. Yeah, so we have to come from a point of empathy when dealing with this issue. Despite the motion's wording, I don't think it's a binary issue per se. There's lots of different systems of political representation we could have. In the event of United Ireland, we could have Storm still out in operation, Storm not in operation. There's a, you know, a multitude of different organisations politically. And you know, it's nearly as if they ever set this motion tonight, knew that there wouldn't really be a conclusion. Maybe there wouldn't be too many minds changed. I don't know if a lot of unions are going to leave this chamber and think, wow, maybe United Ireland is a good idea. You know, I don't think maybe this is the best environment for that. It's nearly as if they knew that the odds we were going to reach an impactful conclusion is slim, but they want the people to start talking and exploring the place. I don't know who sets the motions in the film, but I guess they're really, really cool, great guy. He also happens to be single. His number might be +44 77 24 61 88 69, maybe, who knows? I don't know. Regardless. So I'm going to show that logically, from the ground up, it's better for Ireland to be united both politically and economically. I care about people of the Republic of Ireland, I care about people of the mainland UK and the north of Ireland, and it's precisely this love, care and empathy that leads me to abandon any particular allegiance to these two states, respectively. You can't eat flags, the worms are going to eat my nationalism before any of my fellow citizens will reap its benefits. You have to care about material impact, always. Outcomes-based accountability and political decision-making is required throughout all of this process. So yeah, I believe Northern Ireland can hypothetically work, I honestly do. I don't think the system I grew up in made me any less Irish than anyone else. I don't stand insecure about my nationality as an Irish person. Ironically, over the weekend, I lost my Irish passport. Such is my commitment to this debate, to fundamental nationalism not being tied to material allegiance and political definition. Which leads us to the reality of this. If political unionism believes that their identity can be threatened or undercut by succession to United Ireland, then they either believe that people in the North currently suffer from that vice, by virtue of the fact that their political centre is in London, and are actively complicit and apathetic in a system that does undermine identity, or you believe that political institutions don't define your national identity. Whether I have my centre in London, whether I have my centre in Dublin, shouldn't define my identity. I am as Irish as anyone else is. and the unionists will be just as British if your centre is in London, if your centre is in Dublin. Either conclusion leads to the United Ireland London principle of consent. Polls and statistics tell us that we have a nationalist majority now. We either believe the culture is undermined by having our centre in London or Dublin, or believe it doesn't matter. Either way, you should be open to the idea of United Ireland if it's materially beneficial. If you believe that political institutions do undermine national identity and create harm to students, then you should be raring to call the border poll in the morning by virtue of the fact that you're apathetic towards the majority of the North by that definition. Complicit in continuing harm is by your own succession, but let's talk about some material impacts for the crack. So first, economically. I truly believe that the two greatest achievements ever made by mankind are the moon landing and the European Union. The European Union is the single greatest economic and political project undertaken by humanity. The single market has lifted countless countries out of poverty, global prosperity and ensured peace in Europe. To think about the impact which the European Union has had on the state of Europe and world affairs in general, think about this fact. France can no longer go to war with Germany. That's it. Like, that is the massive impact that the EU's had over the last 100 years. You tell us someone 200 years ago, and it's the biggest shock in the world. You tell us someone 100 years ago, and it's the biggest shock in the world. France can no longer go to war with Germany. The peace and economic prosperity that the European Union has provided has been unprecedented on the world stage. Uniting a country with Ireland will result in some form of joining the EU again. It's an enshrining right to citizens to work, live, start businesses, and travel freely among all states in Europe. This is what the people of Northern Ireland voted for. Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU. Ironically, this would also get rid of the protocol. So that is a win for the DUP when you really think about it. Having an all-Ireland economy will promote shared competencies for healthcare, education, generating innovation and enterprise on the island, the likes of which has never seen before. A good economics means less waiting times, less people die prematurely. Good economics means the capacity for government investment in schools, sustainable architecture, infrastructure, and parks that our grandchildren will play in. The next reason that United Ireland is better is politically. We've heard a lot from the opposition so far about the benefits of a so-called union. The next reason, can a single speaker in this debate tonight honestly give me one reason why they prefer a Conservative government that is tearing its union apart through the worst economic policy project since austerity, which they also did? As they slip further and further down the economic ladder of importance, they shift further and further to the right. We see a democratic blacksiding taking place right now. There is a deep-rooted desperation that is seeping into the UK through their economic policy projects. Mm-hmm. Britain has made a mockery of itself on the world stage through consecutively voting in demagogues in shabby clothing who care about nothing but their pathetic legacy. Britain operates on a reputation of being a once great united nation. Britain was never great and it was never truly united. This is the political centre the North currently abides by, a centre with less projected economic growth than Ireland, a centre with less trade than Ireland. A centre that is the only major world economy out of the top 39 to not reach pre-pandemic levels yet. In the midst of the worst recession, why would we cling to a country that is going to deepen it? More than that, to cling to this country due to your cultural beliefs is to sacrifice the quality of life of our subsequent generations. To not see the massive economic deficits and sheer incompetency in the UK government because you think that one colour of a flag is nicer than the other is to make everyone's loved ones wait longer than possible due to economic deficits. More than this, let's talk about unionist representation in United Ireland. Northern Irish unionist representation, obviously. If we hold a thought in our heads, culture isn't an issue in this debate, since political establishments don't define our identity. Case in point being Ian Marshall, a unionist politician who sat in the Shannon, didn't see any problem with it. Why are these going to United Ireland? The answer is incredibly simple. Given unionism, unionist parties in the North, percentages-wise, will make up a larger percentage of government in United Ireland. Their views will be more represented on the United Ireland than they currently are in the UK. I believe that unionist parties, and you can disagree with me, Steve, I believe they're not one policy parties, which means that if you're more likely to achieve your manifesto through influencing legislation in chambers, through opposing legislation in chambers, through proposing legislation in chambers, because you have a higher percentage of your politicians being represented, because you have a higher percentage of the population, then surely you should believe that on the United Ireland you can do more good. Anyway, let's be ridiculously explicit here. So support the status quo is really, really bad, obviously. All my adult life, I have had little to no political representation because of a collapsed government. The government post-Good Friday Agreement has been collapsed for 37% of the time. We are tied to states shifting further and further towards isolationist policy, a state that never cared about the North in the first place. But let's think about this. If we lived in a world where Ireland was already united, would anyone make the argument for the six counties in the North to join the EU? Would anyone honestly look at the Conservative government in the UK and turn around and tell me, yeah, let's join that, let's get involved? That looks deadly. Oh, real. All the waiting times, that's class, go for it. No one would say that. Uniting the country cannot be viewed as a win for nationalism. It's not going to be viewed nor celebrated as such. It's a win only if it goes on to benefit the people of this Ireland. It's an opportunity, it can go sour and it can be ruined. I care more about representation for and impacts on the people of the North than I do any abstract idea that I have been dealt with through the lottery of being born in a certain household. I believe in United Ireland because of that reason. I've outlined why a united country will be better for the people of the North, economically and politically, and I've also outlined and demonstrated how the policy and acting power of Northern Irish unionism would be greater on the system. I'll conclude with this. Sorry, Alan, I know you've done well with this. Despite the fact that there will be lawmakers, courtrooms and politicians who will challenge, pull and change the fabric of this country when it's united, that's not what's important. Ian Marshall said himself, it's about the country being united and its people. Social change, progression and significant political upheaval happens in households. Constitutions have to change around dinner tables before they truly change in courtrooms. Change starts at home and ends with politics, never the other way around. Ireland's greatest ever politician once said, Difference is of the essence of humanity. Difference is an accident of birth, and it should never be the source of hatred nor conflict. Let's not allow accidents of birth and cultural differences to halt material progress for a bit.
That time of the year in the year Phil's term card where attendance starts to dip, so they go back to the old well and they say, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to do that sexy debate in United. That really gets the punters in. If you know me, and I suppose some of you do in the same way you're kind of known to Garda Síochána, you might think it unusual that I've taken the side I've taken. I agree, it is unusual. I was raised in a background where the concept of Ireland as a country was explained to me in the context of partition, that the counties fought for their freedom against the British Empire, and the British kept six of them illegally and immorally. The good people of the Literific laughed when I said I'd do this debate. My friends in Dublin called me a tan. My grandparents are not currently speaking to me. I cannot blame them. I mess about, I make jokes, but at the end of the day, a united Ireland is something I care deeply about. Ian spoke on unity, so I'm here to speak on contradiction. As much as I want this, as much as it has been bred into me, we need to understand that in one part of this country there exists a majority that don't, and our arguments as to why that position are invalid are themselves invalid. Ireland is disunited, and our solution is to outbreed our opponents, rather than try to prove to them that we're worth joining, we're worth being a part of. There is a contradiction here that rests not within the unionist mindset, but within our own. And until that contradiction is resolved, they will never want to be with us and will grow more and more fearful and in some cases extreme in the face of the prospect. As I grew up, I saw that the partition in our society is not really between the North and the South. It is between those who have power and those who do not. I grew up in one of the richest countries per capita in the world. I went to a university in a city where the average wage was 90,000 euro, that's the median. A city where a century ago we were being described as the worst slum in Europe. Ireland's economic growth is indeed staggering, our progress as a society almost unrivaled. All while the perceptions of our neighbours in the North have stagnated, fallen behind, lost the vigour that once characterised that society. Why then do the unionist people refuse to see the sanity in a united Ireland? We like to treat unionists as immature, as not being able to govern themselves, to look after themselves. But I'd argue that the union sees our contradictions, and they are rightly hesitant to throw their lot in with what is ultimately a broken society. Let's say we raise the tricolour above Stormont. Do the contradictions in our society, wealth beyond belief, homelessness beyond measure, education unparalleled but emigration unopposed, development we once could never have dreamed of, but a culture we will never recover, do these contradictions change? No, they don't. We've achieved economic growth at the expense of understanding what it is about a job that we need to value. Why would you trade guarantees, security, union strength for all we have with the job cuts we've seen just this week? Why would you trade a chance to see your children grow up for $5,000 more of disposable income a year? It's not enough to say that, well, Britain is now driving those into the ground because Ireland offers no alternative to it, except to say, open up your economy to the brutal, unfeeling monster of international corporations who will strip your nation of its soul in pursuit of profit. And it is EU policy to support that through their competition policy. If the average disposable income here is $5,000 more, does that really justify an upheaval the size of what we would need to unite this country? We have sold ourselves. And with the haunted, soulless grin of the capitalists, we look to the unionists to do the same to their little corner of this island. The concept of a united Ireland is not about whether or not Dublin is better than London. It is not about the Oireachtas or Westminster. It is about as if Dublin can be better than itself. If our government had, and country had something to offer beyond empty promises of economic growth and development which will never reach those at the bottom, our concern is in the wrong place, and as long as it lingers there in that pit, nothing is going to improve on this debate. Things here are getting actively worse for our children. We are seeing the return of a ghostly horror which still haunts our cities, the return of the tenement flat. Two of my grandparents were born in tenements, and now chances are I'll probably die in them. The same is true to some extent across the border, but our solution is to tell them that they're just stupid not to join with us, when the problems faced down here are exponentially worse than what they face up there.
Point of information.
Go on.
Just today, Jeremy Hunt announced austerity 2.0 in Ireland.
If you think that next year the same thing isn't going to happen here, I think you're kidding yourself. I fully see an emergency budget happening here. Thank you. Here needs to pivot. We can no longer tell people how things could be better, we need to show them how they will be better. Tom spoke of material benefits, so let's talk, baby. A united Ireland will not make things better for people in the Shankill. It won't make things better for people in the Falls. And you know how we know this? Because united, an independent Ireland did nothing to improve the conditions of people in the Liberties or in Sheriff Street, a community that no longer exists. So why would anyone in that place look to us to solve the issues in a society when we offer them no proof of change, no evidence, no nothing, and ask them to break the link that has defined their culture and people for hundreds of years before we even begin to look at solutions? The harsh truth remains for those of us who call ourselves Republican. Am I signposting it well enough? We should not get a united Ireland because we do not deserve a united Ireland. Our society is rotten. The emphasis is in all the wrong places. The unionist gains nothing from a united Ireland. Nothing worth losing their identity for. We can't give them our identity. We cannot grow the definition of Irish to include those who have an affinity for the monarchy. We sold our identity at auction. We sold it so that we could afford creature comforts and consumerist markets and things that are just ripping out any trace of what we once had. Until we face these contradictions within ourselves, uniting Ireland gains us nothing and costs the Northern Protestant everything. The question is not whether or not we should unite Ireland. It is whether or not we are capable of uniting ourselves and resolving our issues. If we can do that, maybe then people in the North will begin to look south for solutions to problems. But until that day, we're doomed to face another reiteration of this tired old debate, just as we have for the last century. At least the Phil will be grateful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here with you all this evening. And can I just say, the previous speaker, that was a bit pessimistic in terms of an outlook on this item, and I'm going to follow with perhaps a bit more of an optimistic outlook. The question of whether or not we are on the path to a referendum on constitutional change has permeated across all aspects of society. The terms United Ireland, border pool, reunification have become embedded into the vernacular across both sides of the border. To deny that tides have shifted is to deny reality. There now exists a multitude of resources and projects across academia, including the civic space from the Liverpool University, the Deliberating Constitutional Futures from Ulster University, and the Working Group on Irish Reunification at the University College London. There are pro-unity groups, including Ireland's Future, and there are pro-union groups, including Uniting UK. Despite no official reunification campaign in place, 50% and 71% of 18 to 34 year olds in the North and South respectively would vote in favour of a United Ireland today, according to a recent Lusitop poll. Now, Ian spoke of looking backwards, but this conversation is not about looking to the past, it is about the future. Constitutional change presents all of us with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to completely redesign and reimagine the kind of society that we want to live in. It would necessitate changes, including a new constitution. With it, it has the potential for a new education system, a new healthcare system, with improvements in policing, in justice, in housing, and more. Brexit has fundamentally altered this conversation. After all, reunification represents not only a way out from an increasingly hostile British government, but it provides people in Northern Ireland with a way back into the European Union, and that will inevitably attract more than just nationalists.
Here I am. Go. Last month when we were debating instalment, you told us that the protocol offers the best of both worlds in having both access to the European Union and the UK markets. Would we not lose that in the event of the United Ireland lose the dual market access?
Okay, maybe the UK would be open to a trade agreement with a new Ireland. But on your point about the Northern Ireland Protocol, it does raise some questions that unionism does not see the potential economic benefits. It's an economic benefit with the Northern Ireland Protocol, and strategically it would make much more sense to support that than to deny it. But yes, so just going forward, there is no cap, no limit to the possibilities and opportunities that a new Ireland can offer. It could provide us with a healthcare system that is free at the point of access. It can give us an inclusive, modernized education system that harnesses the best practice from both jurisdictions. It could give us a decentralized government, a thriving all-island economy, a new flag, new cultures and traditions. It could even give us the best of all the breakfast fries, the best of the Irish, Ulster and British in one. We could have both caters. We could have dairy milk from the south because the northern ones don't. And we could, dare I say, even have trains back in Fermanagh. And I suppose the other five counties that are missing any rail infrastructure might get them too, but you know, Fermanagh first. Constitutional change is an opportunity to create a progressive, rights-based society that embraces a more inclusive concept of what it means to be Irish. No, it won't be the same Irish state that you have today, but that's not a bad thing. There are systemic problems in both jurisdictions, and this gives all of us a chance to have our say on changing it. There are those on the opposition benches that have spoke of the NHS, as they often do. But the reality is the UK has the worst healthcare access in Europe, largely due to the long waiting lists. And it has created a two-tier system where often people have to go for private healthcare in order to actually get seen.
Yeah? Does the same issue not exist here?
Well, actually, the research shows that the Irish state has better healthcare access above average in the European Union. So. Opposition benches of the economic cost. And I take issue with this idea that Northern Ireland is some dead weight, some burden for the South to have to take on. And these arguments fail to take into account the prosperity that comes from peace and reunification. A process where all of us can participate in creating a new yet familiar Ireland is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We should embrace it. There was also, on the opposition, speaking of two communities existing on this island. That is not true. There are more than two communities on this island. If we look to Northern Ireland, we can see that 1 in 15 people in the recent census were not born on these islands, and they call Northern Ireland home. 1 in 10 in the south call this place home, and they weren't born here either. We are an increasingly diverse island, with diverse views and opinions. As we have heard from the benches, there are those who come from different backgrounds and different communities that are entering this conversation. And to see this as a narrative that is based around unionists and nationalists is just a binary backwards argument that is not reflective of the diverse community we have today.
Yeah.
So to close, and on one final point about uniting people, this argument that we have to unite the people of Northern Ireland first before we can talk about uniting this island fails to account for the change that has already taken place in Northern Ireland. Politics and people are not the same thing. And if you look just to East Belfast, you will see the changes. With an Irish language school, with East Belfast GAA, we are a reconciled people, and it's time we reconciled this island. Article 3 of Bunachna Éireann says, "It is the firm will of the Irish nation, in harmony and friendship, to unite all the people who share the territory of the island of Ireland. Seeking the realization of this aspiration is a constitutional right, and we will all benefit from it. I urge you to support the motion."
It's great to have this opportunity and come to speak to you, because as you know, I'm a member of the Legislative Assembly, and one of the things we don't get to do is talk to anybody. Matter of fact, what we seem to spend most of our time doing is doing sound bites on radio and TV, and it's great to actually have a proper debate when we're talking about the real issues. And as you can see here, I have a big pile of paper, which I'm not going to use, you'll be glad to know. Because I think all the arguments have been made by both sides. But I want to take you on a journey. A journey about what our island, or more importantly, our islands, can look like. Now, first things up, I'm going to tell you a couple of things that might shock you. The first one is I'm a unionist.
Yes.
Second one, wait for it, I'm not a Tory, and I never will be as long as my proverbial points downwards. Indeed, I think I'm probably one of the first unionists who's ever voting for Keir Starmer to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Because actually, I agree, the Tories have made a complete and utter hames, Ulster Scott word there by the way, a complete and utter hames of trying to sort out where my nation, the United Kingdom, is. They have abjectly failed over the last decade. Another fact that might surprise you, I voted to remain. I was part of the Remain campaign. And I remember the day when I was standing outside the polling station, and up to 6 o'clock in the evening, there were young families coming up to me and saying, "Steve, just right, we need to stay in, we need to stay in, because it would be a complete disaster if we go." And I says, "You're quite right." After about 6 o'clock in the evening,
It was like something like out of the Village Out of the Damned. Because people were moving slowly, and they're moving slowly because they're of a certain age, and looking at me, I'm probably closer to that age than most of you are. And every one of them were coming to say, we need to leave the European Union. People in farming communities, we need to leave the European Union because of what they're doing. People in the Shankill Road very clearly saying, we need to leave the European Union. And I said, no, do not. We should not be doing this. Because it's going to fundamentally undermine the relationships across these islands. Now, I started off, when I left the Royal Navy after 32 years, I was the chief executive of the British Irish Chamber of Commerce. That organisation was set up to build the relationships across these islands. The €1 billion worth of wheat trade that went back and forth between the Irish Republic and the United Kingdom. And from that, we actually developed good relationships. And the relationship I remember most is having just had bowel cancer surgery, which was sorted out by the National Health Service, by the way, within the 62 days it was supposed to be, at Anfermeria Hospital. It did exactly what it was supposed to do when it was supposed to do. I couldn't get the same healthcare in the Irish Republic, by the way, where I was working at the time. So I have a personal interest in the National Health Service. But I went in April, and we were sitting in Windsor Castle, and I was presented to the Irish President and to Her Majesty the Queen. And round that room were what I saw was the future of Ireland. Because it was north, south, but it was also east and west. It was about trying to make our islands work better. And I remember after numerous glasses of very nice champagne, I shall say, I remember walking out onto the grass of Windsor Castle and saying, what could possibly go wrong? It did. The relationships across these islands are not good. They're fundamentally broken. The even reason why you have all turned up to listen to this debate tonight is because of Brexit. Because if it wasn't for Brexit, we wouldn't be in the position we are. But we are where we are. Now, 2 years from now, honestly, I think we'll be in a position where we will have a Labour government, please. And on the second point, when we do that, the United Kingdom will be back into some form of Norway plus 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 or some kind of single market access. The problems of the protocol will have gone. But what will not have gone is the breakdown of the relationships we've had across these islands. We need to fix that. We need to fix that by recognising that we are interconnected, intertwined and interdependent. I used to be the chief executive at Dublin City University, and I used to talk to people in the business school and say, where do you want to go? Oh, we want to go to London, or we want to go to Manchester, or we want to go to New York. Why do you want to do that? Oh, because we want to be part of, you know, every single one of them want to work for PwC. Why? I have absolutely no idea. And please do not tell me anybody here wants to go work for McKinsey's. You know, it is an absolute, it is a blight on our island, this sort of attitude towards it as well. But the reality we have to realise is that we are all interconnected peoples. There is a British identity on this island. There will always be a British identity on this island. But what is more, we need to recognise both North and South that that British identity has to be given agency. So what is so fundamentally different between the rights and values of a British citizen or an Irish citizen in Northern Ireland? What is so different about what we can achieve and what we're capable of doing? What is so different about trying to make our island work? But the only way you can make it work effectively is we deal with it in the north, south, and east and west dimensions. And some of the things I don't hear being talked about. You know, we have a major war on Europe. The United Kingdom is part of NATO. We are helping to defend the Ukraine. Ireland, you cannot sit on your own outside of the security umbrella of the West anymore. You can't do it. The world is changing. You can't sit out and say we're not part of it. You need to become part of a greater relationship. You need to join something like NATO. Neutrality is a fallacy. And there is absolutely no way the United Kingdom or the United States or NATO? Is it going to allow an island like Ireland not to be part of some kind of security structure? The reason why people came to Northern Ireland in the first place, or were settled in Ulster or came to Ireland, was to do for security reasons. It was to protect the flank of the maritime nation that was English mission of England. But right now, there is cables going underneath the Atlantic Ocean coming into the coast of Ireland that are unprotected. There are right now that there's Russians and Chinese looking to cut those up and the rest of it. Yet what is Ireland doing about it? We can't forget we have a security dimension of what we need to do. And we've heard about the economics. And, you know, it's great about the economics because you knew I was the chair of the finance committee. And it was great because Conor Murphy was the finance minister. And he did something I never expected a Sinn Féin minister to do. He actually got an independent group to look at the finances of Northern Ireland. We had the Fiscal Commission and the Fiscal Council. Please look at the documents. They're about yay thick. And the really interesting thing about them is that they actually tell the truth track, the real story. How much does Northern Ireland PLC cost a year? 33 billion. How much, when you take about defence and all the rest of it, you take those things out of it, how much does it actually cost? 26.8 billion. How much is our tax take? 19.8 billion. Look it up. Those are the figures. There's a 10 billion difference. But for a country like the United Kingdom, where we've got 3 trillion, I say that again, a 3 trillion GDP, we're the fifth largest economy in the world. We are 67 million people. That's, you know, that is an accounting error. For Ireland to even contemplate where we're going to, or even trying to look at it, you have to sit back and look at the real reality of what it's looking to be. Because my final point before I ask you to please don't listen as Timothy Snyder said, and many of you will know who Timothy Snyder is. He wrote a book on tyranny, and he wrote a lot about the bloodlands and what's happening in Eastern Europe and sort of the challenges that are going on there right at the moment. And he says the thing about it is that the politics and inevitability are a self-induced intellectual coma, and they lead to tyranny and disaster. To say that this is, we should be voting for a united Ireland because of some historic reason or for some made-up economic reason, it's not there. What we should be doing is embracing our relationships across these islands and making all of these islands work together. And that's why I'm asking you not to vote for this proposition. What I want you to do is think about how we can make all of these islands work best together. And for any of you who live in England, Scotland or Wales, and if you get the opportunity, vote Labour. Thank you.
One person.